Well, last Sabbath I took time, sermon time, to start on a subject that requires tremendous time and attention. It's an area that upon Christ's return, much time and energy will go into reprogramming people. We took the time to go through two of five ways that we can and should convey love to our mate. Marriages today, sadly, are not in particularly good condition in general. There certainly are those that have beautiful, wonderful marriages and that are very special and as God would be well pleased with. But there are many more that sadly are not that way. And as we know, statistically, over a long period of time now, essentially, divorce rates have been at least at the 50% level for quite some time. So this is part two of my series titled, How Well Do You Show Love in Marriage? How well do you show love in marriage? Now, I specifically addressed two last time ways to love our mate. Number one was through agape love, which is unconditional, unselfish giving. It is essential in order for a marriage to be successful. You cannot have a successful marriage. You cannot have a marriage that certainly has God's guidance and direction in it apart from exhibiting this. And then I secondly brought out the love of belonging, which of course is also incredibly special and is designed to be in particular, in full bloom within the marriage relationship. We saw that God created us with the need to belong. Now, though these two that I gave last week could perhaps be considered the two legs upon which a marriage should stand, the next three are truly necessary for a couple to experience all aspects of love and appreciation for each other. It takes all five to build what God wants to see in all of our marriages. So I'm going to start now with number three, and that is the love of cherishing. The love of cherishing. Now, the love of cherishing in Greek is called philia, which is P-H-I-L-E-O, which simply means to value highly or hold in high esteem is what cherish means. Filio is used in the New Testament to designate brotherly love, fondness, affection, and cherishing. Physically, I'm assuming, and certainly, hoping that your mate is the most treasured person in your life. He or she should be the most treasured spiritually after God. Now, when I say treasured, perhaps it would be good for me to put it this way. Can you think of something that you treat with special care? Perhaps your car. Right now, I recently purchased a new car. I'm treating it with kind of kid gloves because, you know, anybody gets a new vehicle, what happens is you're all excited about it, and then you get that first ding or scratch, and you just kind of almost want to cry. When you get that first one. After that, you know, it's a little easier to take. But maybe you think of something that you treat with special care, your car. Or your electronics, or your plants, or your books, or your collection of dolls, or your collection of video games, or comic books, or sports cards, your furniture, or perhaps your coin collection. Well, with the exception of plants, all these things are certainly inanimate objects. Now, here's my question. How much more should we treasure or cherish our mate as opposed to these other objects? Unfortunately, too often, people seem to treasure something other than their mate, almost more, if not more, perhaps a hobby, maybe their, in some cases, even their job, more than their own mate. What a terrible and frustrating situation that must truly be, not to mention how wrong that is. Now, as with all forms of love, you cannot get philia. You can only give love. Our Heavenly Father and our elder brother express both agape and filial love towards one another. Let's see both terms used in John's gospel account. Turn with me to John chapter 3 for a moment. Let's take a look at this. John chapter 3. Now here in John 3 and verse 35, we read, "The Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand." Now the term for loves in this verse here is agape. Let's go to chapter 5 and notice verse 20. "For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself does, and he will show him greater works than these that you may marvel." Now here, the use for loves in verse 20 is filio. Now, by the way, Strong's defines filio this way: to be a friend, to, i.e., have affection for, denoting personal attachment, as a matter of sentiment or feeling. So according to Strong's, agape is more of the heart and filio is more of the head. But it should be clear to us that for the kind of complete love that God expects us to have and express towards our mate, both agape and filio are necessary. In fact, it'd be fair to say that they should be very intertwined. Let's think about how we cherish our mate for a moment. Cherishing is what? Cherishing is sharing. Sharing. I'm always saddened by the relationships where you can see that they have reached a point where they no longer really share with one another. Now, there can be different reasons as to, or excuses as to, why it's gotten to that point. But that to me is so very, very sad. The concept and the idea that you just somehow work to a point in life where you no longer just genuinely share with each other. You know, when you're in the dating phase and you're interested in maybe working towards marriage and so on, you're just sharing, sharing, sharing. Well, after marriage, that should never stop. That should continue, always. Sharing is, in this way, is affectionate. Again, this isn't selfish, rather it is the opposite of selfish. So when I say it's sharing, it's important we understand that simply sharing with our mate something we really want them to change because it is, let's say, bugging us, could hardly be called cherishing. Let's turn to Romans and read what cherishing looks like. Romans chapter 12. And by the way, there may be some of us in this room that verbalize a lot more than others of us in this room. So maybe the person who is comfortable with and wants to and does verbalize a lot is saying, "Well, I'm showing cherishing love, but I'm sure not getting much out of the other side because the other side's quieter," let's say. But that's not what we're talking about. Just because one talks more than another, we're talking about something greater than that. In Romans 12 and verse 10, "Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor, giving preference to one another." So Paul describes the love of cherishing as brotherly love. Brothers share. They don't hold back from each other. What would be the purpose, let me ask this, of holding something back from our mate? Now somebody might say, "Well, maybe they don't need to know such and such because it would really bother them to the point that they wouldn't be able to sleep well at night." Okay, well, what would that be? What would possibly fall in the category? Maybe there's some extreme extenuating circumstance situation where you would say, and you might even share with them, "Look, I've got something that happened today that I just want you to know happened, but it's not something that I really want in your mind or head because I don't think it's a good thing and I'm not real excited that I have it in mind based upon what happened." But you've at least divulged something without being closed about it. In other words, there's the care and concern. Maybe there's a rather extreme situation. It would be a rare thing that we would not choose to, if we have a really open and cherishing kind of relationship with one another, that we would not want to actually talk about together and perhaps even pray about together or make you aware. You know, what I think a lot of people get the point where they, you know, maybe somebody's gotten built up all kinds of credit card debt and doesn't want the other one to know. And so as a result, that leads to all kinds of problems, and then one's holding back from another. You know, well, you can already, we all know where that's going to lead ultimately, right? So Paul describes the love of cherishing here as brotherly love. Brothers share, they don't hold back from each other, they don't look to get the upper hand. You know, I implore you to really think about this concept as you consider your marriage. Marriage is definitely not about getting the upper hand, or at least it shouldn't be. In a healthy marriage relationship, what is expressed here in verse 10 should be evident to anyone that might be looking at your marriage from the outside. Verse 10 describes philia, a real cherishing of another person. In biblical times, married couples affectionately referred to each other as sister or brother. Now, I realize sometimes we can read some of this stuff now and think, well, this doesn't fit quite the same way in our culture. But let's go back to Song of Solomon and take a look at what's shared here. In Song of Solomon, chapter 4. As I mentioned last week in the first message on this is really not a book that we turn to that often. And when you read through it, you say, oh, I see why. There wouldn't necessarily be a great need to turn here with frequency, per se, as much as we might some of the other books. But it is important that we do recognize and read it is part of God's inspired word, what is shared. Chapter 4 and verse 10 shares, how fair is your love, my sister, my spouse? How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes than all spices? In sports, they say a tie is like kissing your sister. After reading this verse and thinking about the usage of the word sister, that expression takes on an altogether different meaning. But here's the point. God wants us to see our spouse in a light that most married people, frankly, do not see. Also, as our brother or sister, you and I recognize that, in my case, for example, Colleen has the same goal or objective that I do. We want to be a part of God's family for eternity. You share that. That's incredibly valuable. So in that sense, it is very much a brother-sister type of relationship as well. Here's the point. God wants us to see our spouse in a light that, again, most married people do not see. Now, I've heard many times over the years the statement, well, blood's thicker than water. And the implication is families, i.e. family or mother, father, brother, sister, stick together. And they do so, sadly in many cases, over sticking with husband and wife. Fellow family members, that is not of God. And what we're reading here should make this very clear. This is not about dissing our family, but it is about putting the proper order in place in terms of how God views what should be most important, obviously starting with the relationship with God, then our mate, our children, family, and so on, right on down from there. Not in some other order. A lot of people have their children ahead of their marriage. They've got it upside down. That's detrimental to the children. It's certainly detrimental to your marriage. It's not what God intended, not what he wanted, and it's certainly not what he teaches. Yes, it's special. It's beautiful to add children to the equation. No doubt about it. But they're not above the marriage. That relationship is secondary too. So let me ask you a question. How much sharing do you do with your mate? Now, when you just think about the concept, the idea, sharing, how much sharing do you do with your mate? What is it that you find yourself doing with your time? Do you share it together? Now, I do think, clearly, we all understand there are phases of life. It's important that our children see that we have a very healthy relationship as a husband and wife along the way. But there are also many needs that they may have growing up that you must address and take care of. And so sometimes certain things that you might like to do as a husband and wife get put on the back burner to address that, right? So there are different phases of life. But then as you go into other phases, and they're not there, they're now grown and they're working on their careers and their life and so on, then there's other things that you can pick up in there in the relationship, and that begins to make your relationship even more well-rounded after that phase of life, or into that phase, I suppose I should say. So what is it you find yourself doing with your time? Do you share it together? Or do you find that most of your quote-unquote free time is spent, I don't know, if you're a guy, out with the other guys, or shopping with the girls, if you're a lady? Perhaps your time is with the kids more than one another. I do hope that as we read the Bible and we consider what God has to say and intended, we realize where we might need to make changes in order to have what it is that God desires. I can remember playing in sports leagues in my earlier years of marriage. Obviously past that phase of life now. But I can remember playing a lot of different sports leagues at different times, and maybe one a week in something, and then, but I could play. I would play with guys maybe who, I remember one or two in particular. You know, sort of softball night, then it was volleyball night, then it was bowling night, then it was basketball night, and it was just it never ended. It's like, how do you have time for your spouse? How do you have time with the family and so on? And you know, never seemed to spend time with them. When we were growing up in our household, certainly during the teen years, we had something called family night, which meant once a week, at least during the school year. It was different in the summer a lot of times because we were traveling and moving around everything. But we would have a game night every week, one night a week. And we would rotate who gets to select the game, and we would play together just so we had quality family time together. Depending on where you are in your family, i.e. a new parent as opposed to teens, even grown children, I think it'd be wise also to have date nights with some frequency. And I hope and certainly would encourage any married couple to please be sure to continue to have, or if you do not have or haven't been having, that you make time, carve out time, to have date nights. Treasure your time together. Our time and our relationship should be too valuable to waste. Sharing is doing things together. Perhaps invite your mate to share a hobby. Now, of course, when doing so, pick something that would at least appeal. I think it would be a rather vain attempt. And anything but cherishing, try to talk my wife into joining something that I wanted to do that she has no interest in. I don't really envision us becoming dueling drummers, for example. That's really not sharing filio. That would just be a whole lot of noise, what that would be. Filio's making an effort to work together on projects and being there for one another and sharing and sharing and sharing. I cannot emphasize that enough, because I do believe that this is an aspect of marriage that has been woefully lacking for so many people. Now, when sharing in the way God intended, you find that you have fun together. Yes, you do. Even doing something that at one time was not fun together can become fun as we grow in our love for one another. Well, okay, I'm going to do this because I think this is important for the relationship or whatever. And the next thing you know, this isn't so bad after all. I actually really enjoy it. And this is what came out of it and so on. Sometimes we just need to think outside of our world and our box a little bit more. Sharing is also communicating with your mate. So let me ask you this. How do you communicate with your mate? Do you talk down to one another? Do you lovingly communicate with one another? Do you talk about your mate to others in a way that you shouldn't? But once again, there's communication and then there's communication. Let me explain. Often wives will say, "My husband doesn't talk to me. He doesn't understand." Meanwhile, the husband says something, all she does is talk, talk, talk. Or even worse, nag, nag, nag. "I'm tired of all the talking." Obviously, a couple in this condition is not communicating effectively. I'd like you to think about what I'm going to tell you right now. Effective communication does not start with either listening or speaking. True communication, like true love, starts with giving, outgoing concern. You invest in between your ears first by thinking about what is it that I need to do? What can I do? What do they need? What are they shared with me that I need to be paying attention to? That doesn't require exchanges between, now it will, but really good effective communication, it really starts with outgoing concern. In other words, your concern is, I want to follow what God said, and so I want to make sure I'm conveying outgoing concern. And as a result of that, I listen better, and then I talk and communicate better with my mate. Here's the difference. Too many people are all too busy trying to get others, their mate included, to understand them. If I can just get them to understand me. They don't understand me. I got to get them to understand me. When in reality, all we should be seeking to do is understand our mate. My job is to seek to understand Colleen. My job is not to get her to try to understand everything about me. I trust that she will figure some of those things out, and usually a whole lot quicker than I figure out what I need to be figuring out about her. Because women are typically more perceptive in this way than I think in general than men. Now, there are exceptions to that, but I would say they're more than exceptions. If you think about it, this is the difference between the give way and the get way, isn't it? We all should be seeking to understand our mate, not trying to get them to understand us. Now, that doesn't mean you're not going to have conversations where you say, well, I'm not sure you understand what I'm saying here. You're trying, in the course of the conversation, to address certain things. I don't want that to be misunderstood here. But I'd like to drive home the point that I'm making by sharing some headlines from a magazine that ran for 72 years before it closed its doors in 2004. Now, that's been a while, I realize. But it was called YM, Young and Modern. So you can about imagine the kinds of articles that it would have. It was a magazine designed for teens and young women. Now, I hung on to this over the years because it was such a good example of what I've seen so many magazines for years have been publishing. Let me share with you. On the cover, Love Quiz, Should You Trust Him? Score, Cool Ways to Make Him Yours. Here's the lead of this particular article. It's titled, Sneaky Ways to Win His Heart. Does that sound intriguing? With your tricky tactics, you'll have the cutie completely under your control. Guys are like turtles. If they know you're after them, they retreat into their shells. Be slick, and he'll never know what hit him. Under YM readers confess their sneakiest moves. I saw a really cute guy at a meeting about bringing AIDS quilt to my school, bringing the AIDS quilt to my school. He was on the committee and I needed an excuse to talk to him, so I made up some totally ridiculous question about the project and called him. We wound up dating for a while. Lisa, 19, Baltimore. Here's another one. I was in the school musical with a guy I had a huge crush on. I asked him if he would rehearse with me because there was one scene I just couldn't get right. Of course, it was the kissing scene. Elaine, 15, New York City. 15, mind you. After reading headlines like that, and those were the headlines, the captions, I didn't bother reading any articles, obviously. What does any of this have to do with cherishing someone? The mentality is all upside down. Once again, it's about get, not give. The richest relationships we have in our life are the ones where we are fully invested in giving of ourselves to another. Would we all agree with that? I believe we would. No wonder so many relationships struggle. People are being sold a narrative that promotes selfishness and leads to heartache and destruction. Another magazine article was, "Why Some Women Can't Resist the Lure of Forbidden Passion." I couldn't believe some of the stuff I was reading. Another article from another magazine was titled, "If Your Neighbor's Marriage Looks Too Good to Be True, Look Again, It Probably Is." I'll read one little thing here. It says, I wish I'd taken things further. This is where society has been for a long time. After dieting like a mad woman for 2 years, I managed to get my weight down to 130 pounds, 25 pounds lighter. And I was absolutely thrilled. I joined a gym, and soon everyone was telling me I looked great. Everyone, that is, except my husband, Ron. More than anything, I wanted my husband to be proud of me, but he never even mentioned my transformation, although it was so obvious. I didn't say anything to him about it, but I agonized and suffered inwardly until one day I just decided, forget Ron, it's time to get to know Phil. I'd met Phil at the gym. He had the great body you'd expect of someone who spent hours lifting weights. So again, look where we are and the level we're talking about in this, of the mentality that's there. We'd often go for a drink at the end of workouts, having long conversations about nothing. Then one day he asked me straight out, cool as a cucumber, "Have you ever considered having an affair?" I giggled nervously. I don't think so. Why? I walked with him to the parking lot in silence. And I won't go on from there except to say that ultimately she said she couldn't cheat on Ron, but let's face it, she already had, in the way God describes what's involved. I mentioned a little while ago that cherish means to value highly. When you value highly your spouse, you would never, ever get to that point. You would know better. Nothing about it would feel right, be right. It wouldn't be right before God. Nothing about it would be healthy. When I read something like this, it seems rather obvious to me that this woman most certainly does not value her husband highly. Nor, for that matter, does he appear to value her highly. It concludes with her saying, "Although I didn't cheat on him," although you and I would agree that she already did, "he still doesn't treat me right, so maybe I should have." That was her final conclusion in the matter. Now, I trust we can understand with clarity that what I just read to you is nothing short of selfish, damaging, and of Satan. He's the one who would love to get all of us to read that and not see anything wrong with it. This is the opposite of how God wants us thinking. What this magazine article doesn't realize is that these two, again, were already having an affair, just without the physical portion, or at least a portion of the physical portion. Their minds were already invested. They were working out and then going out together afterwards. She was already cheating on him. Husbands and wives, please value your mate highly. Please value your mate highly. Learn to understand the give way by asking God to help you. It's important we learn what is involved in this so we can see how far out there this type of thinking in the magazine really is. The emphasis in our marriage should be placed on giving to the other. Seek to understand what your mate wants to share rather than to get your mate to understand you. The approach to communication will open many new opportunities for sharing. I found an Elbert Hubbard quote that I found rather telling concerning getting in a marriage as opposed to giving. And here's the quote. "The trouble with many married people is that they are trying to get more out of marriage than there is in it." How does it get to that point? Because we don't invest in the way we should. We can't change the other person. We can only change us, of course. Cherishing also includes touching, not groping, but touching. In a cherishing relationship, there is neither one extreme or the other. Groping or untouchables, if you will. Your marriage is missing a great deal of joy if you classify them as something untouchable. Couples often touch too much when they're dating. for all of you teens or after teens, but appear to be handcuffed after they get married. Lovers do love to touch. It sends the message that I love you. It tells your mate you're important to me. I cherish you. And likewise, the lack of touching conveys the exact opposite meaning. I realize some don't need it as much as others, but it's an important part of a marital relationship. Give your mate a warm hug in the morning. Sit close together at home or in the car. Can't do as much in the car. They're all bucket seats now. I remember the first car I had. You slide right on over. They don't have those anymore. Reach over and lovingly hold hands. Most of you are probably familiar with the story about King Midas. It's been a long time since I've read that story. The story goes, everything that he touched turned to gold. It wasn't too long before he was very sorry they made that wish. Well, in this case, the loving touch turns everything to love, and that is not a bad thing. Share with your mate, communicate, reach out and touch, and you will give Filio the love of cherishing. The fourth way to love in our marriage is through Eros, E-R-O-S, which is romantic love. God inspired a whole book of the Bible, the Song of Solomon, to describe the proper kind of romantic love in marriage. I don't know when the last time you went through that book was, or if you've ever done that with your mate, but if you haven't, or it's been a while, perhaps it's time to go through it once again. I'm going to guess that you will enjoy it. You might even chuckle a time or two. There's another story in the Bible that jumps to mind along these lines. It's found in the book of Genesis. So let's go to Genesis chapter 29. Genesis 29. Let's begin at verse 15. Then Laban said to Jacob, because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing, tell me, what should your wages be? Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel. And notice this phrase here. They seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Now, if we told our son or daughter, well, I would encourage you to have a good 7-year relationship before you figure out or before you actually get married. I mean, I can only imagine how some might view this today. But I love what this says here about they seemed only a few days to him. Now, this story of Jacob and Laban took quite a turn, as we know, because Laban tricked Jacob, and Jacob ended up serving 14 years in actuality for Rachel. But again, those 7 years, as we see here, seemed but a few days to him because of the love that he had for her. Only romantic love could make 7 years seem like a few days. Jacob was high on Eros. The bottom line is this. Romantic love is real, and we really need to express it to our mate. In many cases, wives have little trouble understanding Eros. Quite often, they may even say to their husband that they would really like more romance. Some are starving for romance. Sadly, all too often, husbands tend to ignore romance and do not fulfill their wives' needs in this particular way. Men, consider what Eros is. Do a study on your own. Research this term and how well you express that to your wife. Do you understand what romance is? Someone can say, I know I felt the same way when I was, I'm not a romantic guy. That's not me. I don't know how to be that. Well, learn how to become that. It's important. It's another way that we show love to our wives or our wife. Go study it. Learn what it is. Talk to your wife and ask her to share what she believes it is. Now, this is fun to learn from one another. By the way, she shouldn't have to tell you everything. You got to do your own work and research. I think sometimes we men can be a little pig-headed about some of these things. We're a little thick on some of it. And I might be being a little harsh in one sense to the men because I feel like I've got a little leeway to be able to go there. And that it's important that we do provide everything that makes the marriage more full and complete. This is fun to learn from one another and to talk about how to make your marriage more rewarding. As I alluded to in the first message, and I will reinforce today, the more we learn and understand how to give love in the ways we are discussing, the more positively our intimate part of the marriage is impacted. We'll talk about this a little more in a little while, but it seems in so many relationships, people try to solve their problems from intimacy or sex backwards. In other words, some people try to fix that aspect of life in marriage in hopes that it will take care of everything else in the marriage. In actuality, it's the other way around. Learning how to love in all other areas of life will in turn strengthen the physical aspect of love. Let me give you three keys to developing romantic love. I'll list them and then we'll go through each of them. So three keys to developing romantic love. Number one, climate. Number two, imagination. And number three, surrender. Climate, imagination, and surrender. Now, climate is the temperature of your relationship. If you're interested in your spouse, the temperature of your relationship is not icy cold, is it? It's warm. If the temperature is cold, that's definitely not a good thing. Romantic love does not occur in a cold relationship. Secondly, and again, I'm going to explain, I'll go share more about each of these, but I just want to kind of capsulize here a little bit first up front. Imagination. If the temperature or climate of your relationship is warm, you also are also thinking more, which means you are more imaginative. That's a good thing. Somebody might say, "Well, I'm not poetic. I don't know how to write a loving, sweet poem to my wife or a story or a." What are we going to use that as a cop-out to not do it? We might be surprised at what we find there if we just try. We begin to work on it. You use your imagination more. You're creative in coming up with activities you know your mate likes. Your language is more creative. You pay attention to what excites them so you can bring it up in conversation. You show that you are engaged in the relationship in such a way that your partner can see and know that you're fully engaged in it. And then last one is surrender. You're happy to serve the other person. For example, he'll get your car door. She'll make him special treats. You'll both get creative gifts for one another. Colleen was much more gifted in this from the get-go than I will ever be. But I have gotten better. It's taken a while. Okay, I'm sharing insights into our marriage to say I do think about things a lot more than I ever used to when I was first starting in this. Why? Because it's important to me, and I know it's important to her. I want to have the richest relationship I can possibly have on this earth with her. You're about giving to the other person because the climate is good, which in turn engages the imagination and leads to surrender. For many people, the climate and the imagination changes when they get married, and obviously that then leads to change in willingness to surrender. Well, I thought they were this way, but this is what I found out afterwards, or this is what's happened. So everything just kind of tails from there. You've probably heard people say or have said yourself, just wait until they aren't newlyweds anymore. That'll change everything. And they mean that not in a positive way, unfortunately. For years, I've told young couples when they get married, this is awesome, isn't it? And guess what? It's only going to get better and better and better. Because that's what God intended. And it will be that way if both parties invest in that way and truly follow what God teaches. Prince Philip, consort of the recent queen's death, and of course he was first to go before her, was quoted as saying, "When a man opens the car door for his wife, it's either a new car or a new wife." Now, it's meant to be funny, but I also find it sad. What happens to the romance? Another quote by Helen Rowland. She said, "Before marriage, a man will lie awake thinking about something you said. After marriage, you'll fall asleep before you finish saying it." Clearly, the romance is gone. Well, as I said a moment ago, the climate in our lives is very telling. Eros is emotional and sensitive and requires a warm climate to flourish. For example, do you rub your mate's feet because they like that? Do you write them poetry because they enjoy that? Do you surprise them with a small gift periodically that reflects you put a lot of thought and care into that gift? Let's go to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4. Here in Ephesians 4, I'd like to read verse 32. "Be kind to one another and tenderhearted." Do you realize how hard that is for some people in marriages? How tragically sad. Be kind to one another. Tenderhearted. Forgiving one another even as God in Christ forgave you. When that's what's needed, that's what we do. There's a lot we can take from this, and it's designed to point out how we should treat our fellow human beings. But the first phrase in the verse also addresses the concept of eros in marriage. Yes, God wants us to be kind to one another and tenderhearted. When we start thinking along those lines, we get more creative. He also wants us to be kind and tenderhearted towards our mate as no other. Show your creativity in your relationship and how you communicate with your spouse. And what you share with them. Fellow family members, our responsibility to project a warm, positive attitude towards our mate and a mindset that shows that we can be romantic. Ask God to help remove any negative feelings that you may have had in the past or still have. If necessary, make a new beginning in your relationship. Your giving of kindness will go a long way in producing a warm climate for romance. Now, certainly under climate would come grooming. Since eros is sensitive to scent and sight, our grooming or lack thereof can affect the climate. Different cultures have different standards and expectations along these lines. In this country, we tend to be very conscious of how our body smells. So we use deodorant and perfumes and soap, deodorant soaps and nice-smelling shampoos, etc. Unless, of course, we're allergic to those, then we can't. But we're still trying to do the best we can to maintain being clean. And that helps make for a more romantic environment, of course, than if we didn't do that. What about the look of love? Let's go back to Song of Solomon again, chapter 4. We were here earlier. Remember, we were here talking earlier, and it says in verse 9, "You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with the look of your eyes and with the link of your necklace." Solomon tells here of the power of the romantic eye contact. Couples who love one another look at one another. It's been said that the eye is the mirror of the soul. It's also true that the eye is the mirror of love. Why not send the message, "I love you," from your eyes to your mate's heart? Most of the time, I go to the bed after my wife does. She tends to go earlier, I go later. She tends to get up earlier, I tend to get up a little bit later. Every once in a while, I'll crawl into bed, and when she's asleep, I just simply look at her and gaze for a little bit. And as I do, I may be thinking all kinds of things that from what we did that day to the days when we were dating, to the blessing of being grandparents, so many rich things and experiences in life. I know, too much information for the teens in here. Here's the bottom line. When your love for your mate, you have love for your mate deeply, you find yourself doing these things. That's beautiful. Nothing warms the romantic climate like the giving of affection. It seems that the age we now live in has been stripped of its natural affection. This is a much colder, aloof society. Think about how the neighborhood relationships have changed from what they used to be, even. Unfortunately, many marriages also reflect this coldness. The only way this changes is to do something about it. I've got a neighbor who lives next to me. I think I've shared with you before about him. And he was sharing with me a story the other day at the house with me. And he said, I can't get the neighbor across the street to just look and be nice and wave at me. He said, I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I said, I don't imagine you're doing anything wrong. I'm just listening to what's going on. And I'm a little worried because he did wave at me yesterday. But anyway, I don't know. Point is, even neighborhood relationships are very different than what they used to be, sadly. Kissing has always been a symbol of affection and warmth. Why not make kissing your official form of greeting your mate? I'm assuming that you do that. A kiss in the morning to start the day. A kiss at night are good ways to end the day, begin the day and end the day. And I hope that you're doing that. Chapter 1 of here in Song of Solomon, verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Solomon's bride desired his kisses. We've probably got some kids in here who are saying, that's in the Bible? Yes, that's part of God's inspired word. It's designed to help us understand that God intended the marriage relationship to be incredibly special in every possible way. God covers everything in the Bible. The second aspect of developing romantic love is to use imagination. Romance is all in the mind. The imaginings of your mind can be a powerful tool in becoming more romantic towards your mate. Let's go to Matthew 5 for a moment, if you would. Because it's important we understand what God also equally doesn't want. We want to see what God does want, and we want to be able to contrast that with what he does not want. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 28, this is the words of Jesus Christ. I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, this is obviously speaking about outside of marriage. Having said that, how do we view our wife? Do we view her in a healthy way, even when it comes to this? Intimacy. This obviously shows we're not to desire or have lustful thoughts about someone, again, who's not our mate, but this does show us the power of imagination as well. So God wants our imagination to be directed properly, not incorrectly. And when it is, it's very good for your marriage. But when it's not, it's very damaging to your marriage. Proverbs 5. In Proverbs 5, let's take a look at verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Verse 19, as a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. We're not trying to look outside for any of this. Ever. When your mate is out of sight, never let him or her be out of mind. Early on in our marriage, There's a period of time where my wife went, as most everybody here knows, I was born in Australia and spent the first 7 years of my life over there. And just it turned out to be a case later in life, interestingly enough, one of Colleen's good friends from college was from Australia. And so must have been maybe a couple of years or so after, I could be incorrect in the timing, but I believe that's around that time frame. A couple of years or so later, she was in Australia to go visit her friend. And I was back in the United States. And I guess I had made the comment when I was leading songs one day or something about, it's just not the same with my wife not here and so on. And there's only, such a huge void that only she can fill. And I didn't feel like I had bemoaned anything or drawn anything out. But I got a big chuckle, or at least Colleen got a big chuckle out of when she did come back. One of the deacons ran up to her and said, "I am so glad you're back. We don't have to listen to Mark anymore." It's complaining, apparently, and I didn't realize it even was. Today we have the benefit of cell phones, and so Colleen and I were able to talk to each other every day when she spent the last couple of summers up north for a couple months at a time helping her parents, leading up to the time that both of them actually died, one last summer and the one the summer before. Part of the time we're on the phone was certainly romantic conversation. I talk about a lot of different things, but part of it is certainly romantic conversation. Use your heart and imagination to create positive, pleasing thoughts about your mate. Now think about your mate's attractive qualities. Hear his or her warm and reassuring voice. See that beautiful smile. Take mental stock of your mate's inner as well as outer beauty. When we use our mind and imagination, our thoughts will reinforce our feelings and actions of romantic love, like we're talking about here. Excuse me, as you read about in Song of Solomon. And if we do this, we will find that we also surrender, which is the third aspect of Eros or romantic love. Eros requires a desire to surrender and give ourselves completely to our mate. And this, of course, means not withholding romantic love. Not sexual love, but romantic love. They are different. As I said at the beginning of this point, women in particular need this, and it's important that a good husband provide that. By the way, I'm not trying to indicate that women are off the hook. It's just that when most people think of this, they think through the lens of the typical man-woman relationship. The truth is that both should be seeking to improve and share romantic love. Again, going back to what I've always said, we work on us. We don't work on somebody else. Now, this brings us to the final point that I would like to talk about today and what will bring a conclusion to the series. And that is the fifth way to love our mate is with sexual love. Now, I'm not asking you this looking for an answer at all, but if asked the question, how is your love life, what would your answer be? Now, I certainly hope that your answer would be something that God would be pleased with, and you would too. The truth is that God intended this aspect of love to be pleasurable and fulfilling just as much as the other aspects. What I'm about to give you now is what people pay the big bucks for at the newsstand or at the checkout counter in the grocery store, how to have a better sex life. 10 ways to make sex better is the way they always put it, that kind of thing. You know, actually, the place to start improving your intimacy, your sex life, is with the application of the first 4 points. That's it. That's the answer to have the best quality that you can possibly have in your relationship. Truthfully, this last point has been placed last in the series of points because its success is really dependent on the other areas, not the other way around. If you are to improve this aspect of your life, first, improve the rest of your marriage. There, I just gave you in a couple of sentences what people take entire books to try to tell you. Actually, sadly, most people don't really even connect marriage and sex together anymore. Instead, most seem to see them as completely separate issues. You don't need to be married, they would say, to have sex, so this point is moot. At least that's what many think. Of course, here in God's church, we're interested in following what God actually teaches, His instruction. The narrow path that most do not choose. And we do that because God has called us and we recognize that it is the only way that leads to living eternally in God's family. So consider, if we desire to have a great life of intimacy within our marriage, don't we find it much easier to want to give that to each other when we have already been spending time and energy and attention on giving in all the other aspects and components of marriage, which needs to be there in the first place? That's what brings us close and desirous of being together. We can never afford to forget that when we do things God's way, it always works and leads to the best outcome. Again, the attention is on give as opposed to get. We could go out here and buy a book that tells us all kinds of things to try to supposedly perk up your life of intimacy, but it just isn't going to happen as we would like until we get everything in the proper order. If you don't do what God says and you save that for don't save that for marriage, you're not going to have what you can have if you do it God's way. And it's going to lead to a lot of problems and a lot of heartache. Just as our relationship with God must come before our marriage, our children come after our marriage. The same is true of sexual love. It's better when and only when we first implement the other aspects of showing love in our marriage. That person needs to know exactly what they mean to us. At no point is the other person a slab of meat, if I'm going to be blunt. Now, the prudish Victorian approach to sex as being one of the necessary evils of life is wrong, just as the modern new morality is also wrong. To properly give sexual love to your mate, you need God's positive attitude toward it. God created sex. He says it's good in a marriage. Genesis chapter 1. Again, in a marriage. Genesis 1. Not outside of a marriage. Verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. And then it proceeds to go on from there. What you will find over time is that as you mature in other aspects of your marriage, you will then also mature in the area of sex. And it is with this maturity that you can appreciate the experience as no book can tell you. But instead, as God created to be something joyful and special that is only between you and your mate. Now, I'll be perfectly frank with you guys. It takes a certain maturity to appreciate what I'm sharing here. Because we're living in an environment that when you talk about something of this nature, people want to smile, they want to giggle, they're lighthearted about this or what about that. And I get it. I understand what the world is offering. But what we're addressing and looking at here, for those that are spiritually mature, recognize how important this truly is and how beautiful it is in the marriage relationship. Hebrews 13. I think it's important we be willing, when and where that's needed, to talk about things that may not always be easy for some to talk about. But I think as long as you're doing this through the lens of what God shares and guides us down the path to see and to recognize is always a good thing. Hebrews 13, notice verse 4. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Now, for the word bed, Paul uses the Greek word koite, which literally means cohabitation or coitus. The translators of the authorized version of the Bible were ashamed to use the word coitus, so they used bed. And the revised authorized version perpetuates this translation. But God's not ashamed of this beautiful act of love. At one point, neither were Adam and Eve. Let's go to Genesis 2. And notice that there were things that they saw very differently before Satan entered the equation. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 25. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Satan got to them in the Garden of Eden. But until that time, they were in no way ashamed of the act of lovemaking. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Let's go there. 1 Corinthians 7. First Corinthians 7 and verse 3. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. And this involves both of the last two points that I've been stressing here in this message. We have a God-given responsibility to give to one another this particular love and satisfaction to our mate. Our body belongs to our mate. Our mate's body belongs to us. Notice verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. With that authority comes the responsibility to take care of your mate's body as it is your own. Again, everything with God is about caring for one another. Hold your place here. We're going to come back. Let's go to Ephesians 5 for just a moment. Ephesians 5, verse 28. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. We never want to abuse our mate's body. That's not loving. We are to handle with tender and loving care. We are to do everything we can to give them what they want because we love them. Give them what they need within the proper bounds of what God intended. Not because we've picked up some crazy idea off of something we read or saw that we should never had in our heads in the first place. Find out what it is that they like and don't like, and by all means, we should never refuse to give sexual love to our mate or use it as a weapon or leverage, ever. 1 Corinthians 7, back to that, verse 5. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Refusing to give sexual love can irritate, agitate, cause frustration and tension in a marriage. With an attitude of withholding or refusal, it's an attitude of selfishness, not selflessness, over seeking to love and please her mate. I should say, however, it is every bit as selfish for one to insist on sexual pleasure under any and all circumstances. Obviously, there are times it's simply not appropriate, or perhaps the timing or stresses of life that in particular are off-putting at that particular time. So it is neither right to force or to withhold. Neither of those come from love, true love and care and concern for another. In the New English version of the Bible, Song of Solomon 5 and verse 1, it says, "Eat, friends, and drink until you are drunk with love." So just as the other four ways of love, your mate, sexual love, when done in the spirit, it was intended by God, produces great joy and fulfillment. Ecclesiastes 9. Ecclesiastes 9. And verse 9. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun. all your days of vanity, for that it is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. God's admonishment here is to live joyfully with our wives, men. This will take place if we live the five steps we have gone through in the last couple of weeks. Obviously, this is true of women as well. Express your love through your mate, for your mate through agape. Express love for your mate through the love of belonging. Express love for your mate through the love of filio. Express love for your mate romantically. And express sexual love to your mate. Now, if we follow, live, and pray about this, we will find that our marriage will mature, and of course, we individually will mature also. Perhaps this is really what we need to think about in the big picture. Isn't success in virtually all aspects of life contingent upon our drive and our discipline in our obedience to God? Really, when you think about it, that's exactly what we're talking about again today. When our relationship with God is mature, then we will be able to have a much more mature relationship in our marriage with one another. Now, obviously, if you're married to someone who does not know the truth or does not care to know, then there are definitely some added challenges for you. But everything we've been going through is still the truth, and if practiced, is very rewarding. Now, we recognize 1 Corinthians 13 to be the love chapter, so I'd like to close today by going over here and looking at four verses in particular that do define in how God views the subject of love. 1 Corinthians 13, and let's begin in verse 4. Love, and think about this now in relation to your marriage. This is not, yes, we're supposed to treat everybody with it this way, but think about it right now and hone in on your marriage. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not puffed up. It's real. It's genuine. Does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. Is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. You know what the bottom line is telling us right there? That we can sleep well at night if we know we have practiced what this taught. Even if somebody doesn't accept something well, if we know before God we did this, we can sleep better at night than if we know we didn't. In our marriage, we will undoubtedly face opportunity after opportunity to put this into practice. There will be times that we'll fall flat on our face, but there will also be times that we live this and great happiness will be the reward. Now, when I say love you to our mate, or when we say I love you to our mate, do we recognize what we are really saying? I mean, for many of us anyway, we say I love you a lot to our mate. But couldn't that just become words? Do we understand what all that entails? We can never really sneakily win someone's heart, as the article in the magazine implied. If we give mature love to our mate, we will find that we also have their heart. Marriage can and should be the most beautiful of all physical relationships. God wants and expects us to have respect for one another and all kinds of fun along the way. Make a disciplined effort to continually strengthen this crucial relationship by sharing with one another what God designed us to share.